Welcome, welcome, welcome. This is part two of episode 102 with Colin Murray. Great conversation and great to talk to. If you enjoyed the first part of that and enjoying this in general, I've had Zane Lowe on previously, Hugh Stevens, Rob the Bank, John Kennedy. All of these people come up in this podcast at one point or another. So if you enjoyed this one, I recommend you scroll through and check them out. We're always sponsored by speechdevelopmentrecords.com. That's my record label. If you could support there, that'd be fantastic. We've got stickers, t-shirts, of vinyl mugs. We've got barbecue aprons. We've got everything you could possibly want. Yeah, head there. Just quickly, we touched briefly on mixed martial arts in this one, and we kind of skimmed past it. Or was it in the last one? I can't remember. But we were going to talk about it a bit more and then come back to it, and we didn't. But Colin mentions that there'll be some people tuning in thinking, oh, it's barbaric. I just wanted to have a quick word on that, because to me, it's the most beautiful sport in the world. It's far less barbaric, for example, than boxing and other things like that. Or, I mean, there's far less injuries and, you know, dare I say, long-term effect and death than in American football, than in rugby, than in boxing. I think in the UK, it gets a bad press of being cage fighting, which... it's not, it's mixed martial arts. Like, sometimes it's in a cage or an octagon. Sometimes it's in a ring. You know, there's all sorts of situations for it. And it's, yeah, for me, it's the most beautiful and technical sport out there. And I love boxing. I love football. I've got into rugby in recent years. There's a lot of sports I adore, but mixed martial arts is the one for me. Oh, and of course, actually, I should mention that since the drunk podcasts, which we did the last few weeks, where we talked a little bit about MMA, since we recorded them, so after we recorded them but before they went out, huge things happened with Brock Lesnar being announced at UFC 200, Michael Bisping being the first British UFC champion ever, Conor McGregor and Nate Diaz being announced at UFC 202. Loads of good stuff going on, so it's all very exciting, and I'm sure we'll talk about that on another drunk cast down the line. But for now, I will just get on with this and allow you to enjoy part two of Colin Murray on the Distraction Pieces podcast. This piece of fiction is the intro to Distraction Pieces. This piece of fiction is the intro to Distraction Pieces. This piece of fiction is the intro to Distraction Pieces. And now we're starting part two. Nice. Obviously, behind the curtain, we've not paused in any way. This has gone straight into it.
We had a break. We went for a swim together, and then we're back.
And let's talk about Radio One, because it gets a love and it gets hate, and I think it probably deserves both in ways. But you jump straight onto daytime, essentially, there, right?
Writing my magazine, writing columns, living with a friend, still living a very kind of, it's exactly a lifestyle I expect a student to be living, even though I wasn't a student, I never did beyond 16, but I lived that, still in that lifestyle, like going to gigs and out and getting up to all sorts of nonsense. And
it was a way of life, not an occupation.
I know, exactly. And there was interviews for the evening session with Steve Lamack on a Thursday night. Was going to have a Welsh show, a Scottish show, and a Northern Irish show. And I knew, because of running the magazine and it being a very small scene, I knew the producers and the people involved in trying to put that together. And they said, you got to come down and do it. You run the magazine. This is perfect for you.
Yeah.
And I said, I have no fucking interest in ever working in radio. I didn't have huge radio heroes growing up. Yeah. I had people who wrote who I admired a lot more. So I was like, I've not really got a huge interest in this. Yeah. I don't want to come down. And they actually did a round of auditions, found the female presenter, Donna Legg, and couldn't find the guy.
Right.
Came back to me and said, will you do it? And I was like, I've told you I have no interest. And finally bugged me that much. I went, okay, I'll come down. And I remember it was after being up all night during one of the World Cups, after like 36 hour session with my mates just watching football and playing the computer and being absolutely wiped, and going down bleary eyed and doing this weird audition on a desk for a Radio 1 show, and I got it. And then all of a sudden, like fast forward like a month, I'm sitting outside a bar in Belfast doing a press launch with Steve Lamack, you know. Yeah. It's bizarre.
How quickly did you fall in love with it? Because it's a weird one with radio. Because I was similar with when I had my show on XFM. I had to have my arm twisted so much to do that, because I was like, I'm not into it. But then as soon as I started to play stuff and realised that there's certain songs that haven't got any exposure in this country. Yeah. And, and remembering, again, I guess I had that weird advantage of remembering how much it meant to me to get that first airplay or to get that bit of play, then realising, damn, I'm giving a lot of bands or rappers their first ever airplay in the UK and stuff like that. And it suddenly made me go, oh, wow, I'm into this, when I didn't think I would be.
I would say the only thing I associate with the first couple of years of doing radio was fear.
Really?
I think I remember the first link ever, which hopefully doesn't exist. I remember the tears of like adrenaline rolling down my face. It's the only time adrenaline's ever came out in the form of tears.
Yeah, yeah.
And just being in an awful world of pain feeling exposed.
Hugely.
Because
in
I
deep
am,
end,
and it sounds a strange thing to say, but I'm sure you maybe have had it quite a lot because you do these long form interviews and people will say this, maybe it's more common, but I'm fairly antisocial and fairly introvert and very socially awkward.
Yeah.
You know, I can't do the whole how's your day, what do you do for a living type chats.
Yeah.
I am 1 second away from going, would you rather have sex with, you know, I'm always one step away from saying the inappropriate thing, you know, and it's just
completely
the way my brain works.
Yeah.
So it wasn't, I learned on air how to sort of streamline this thought process, and it wasn't easy. And you know, I had very bad moments and good moments. And
that fear of swearing or going in any direction that you shouldn't go.
But even just this, even just the ability of, say, for example, if I go, so the thing was, you know,
just
into going like this into the microphone. It's those things you learn.
Yeah.
Like even just distance from the microphone takes a few years.
Yeah, definitely.
So I became obsessed with listening to certain shows. Jerry Anderson, who's my all-time radio hero. He was the only one before I started working in radio I loved.
Yeah.
This guy who had this show on Radio Ulster and Radio 4, who, it was an hour and a half, that's how much of a legend he was.
Yeah.
He passed away, unfortunately, recently. And he did this fantastic show where he'd have people on who would just phone up and go, Jerry, there's a bird at the bottom of my garden, don't know what it is. And that would be it. That would be the hour and a half from there.
Brilliant.
And people were laughing at and with and together and apart. And he was just this raconteur on air who, he was always the guy who joined the band he joined the band after Bob Dylan left.
Right.
You know, that type of thing. He was always one step away from being the most famous fucking man in the world.
Yeah.
And ended up back home. So I learned a lot from, pardon me, talking to him and listening to him.
Yeah.
But so those first years at Radio 1 were regional, filling in for Steve Lamacq. So looking back on it now, I remember that press launch. And I remember Steve Lamacq saying at the press launch, that kid will replace me, by the way. And I always thought, he was like, why the hell did he just say that?
He must have said it
in every interview. And then the guy who was putting the show together, he went, no, that was the really out of character for him. And it always stuck with me. And I think it gave me a lot of confidence that this guy had seen something.
Yeah.
And I was so passionate, you know, not saying I'm not passionate about music now, but I'm now all of a sudden listening to jazz records and stuff that I don't necessarily have to be angry about anymore. I can actually enjoy them more and not
just
fight a cause.
Jazz
has fought its cause already.
Yeah.
It doesn't need me.
Yeah.
And I just remember, like you say, I developed quite a militant love of sort of taking a record and making people connect with it. And it is that simple. And you've got to listen to everything you're sent. That's the key. And that's your real job. The hours and hours and hours and hours to find that one record that you go.
Because that's it. That was the birth of a key part of the real new music initiative of Radio 1.
Yeah.
Obviously, you'd had always had Peel, but that was the birth of kind of, right, we're going to make an active thing of, and again, I associate you and Hugh and even like Rob the Bank and Zane in many ways as well as the ones there that even in the era where people into indie or whatever else would turn their nose up so much at Radio 1, it's like, but these guys are taking these songs to the next level. These are absolutely key.
Well, it was interesting because I had the sort of the crossover to working in London. I took various TV shows, Good, Bad and Terrible, to try and get more into London to get a National Radio 1 show. And it was between myself and a mad New Zealander to take over an evening session. And they demoed us time and time and time and time again. And there was a real split in the building, and then they went for Zane, which was probably the right choice. And they said, look, can you do 6 months until he's available? Which at the time, I don't know, maybe your ego's smaller than or whatever. I'm not sure whether I would have accepted it now, but I went, yeah, fucking may as well.
Sure.
And from that, weekends with Edith, and then quite quickly they moved us on to the daytime. And in my head, I'm going, fucking hell, Daytime Radio 1 show in the days when you had free plays that had huge impacts, like this one massive record impact. An hour.
Yeah.
Fucking huge. And it's such a shame they don't have it now as a rule. But, and they went, you've got it. And we went, brilliant, what show? And they went, Mark and Lard. And we just went, oh, fuck. You know?
Yeah.
And that's why sort of like, I seem to always, and all my career, have been given the poison chalice.
Yeah.
In every job that I've got. And I don't know why I keep getting the poison chalices, yeah. But... And I'm not to sound arrogant, but I've always succeeded in those poison chalices in radio. But, you know, and we went on to smash the ratings record and that and break some good music. And, you know, I remember again Mark Radcliffe said, I'm glad it's you too. Oh, you know, and that meant a lot. But they were my I'd grown to love them and all of a sudden we were replaced. And I hated that.
I always remember when Edith teamed up with Adam Buxton on Six Music. Yeah. And I remember at the time a lot of people going, how can anyone be other than Adam and Joe and all this?
Yeah.
And I was always just straight away, I was like, did you listen to Edith and Colin?
Yeah.
And Edith was like, she's great bouncing back and forth with someone. Yeah. And it was such
she's a very good, unselfish.
Yeah, completely.
Yeah, you can't really have two people like each other, you know.
No.
You got to have, and we're still, funny enough, she works in this building now for Virgin, so we see each other every day again, which is really
that's
good.
Great. But
I nearly moved next to her. That was a bit weird recently.
So how was it having someone to share the pressure with? Like you said, those first few years felt always as if you were about to fall off or about to be exposed.
Well,
how was it
well,
to have someone that you're like, right, we've been slung together and it's worked and we're trusted? And do you know what I mean? Like, was there a level of safety in numbers?
Absolutely. My whole career up until fairly recently, as in, well, I'm about to turn 40, but at least up until 28, 29, 30, 30, maybe even my first full-time Five Live contract, I've been running my whole life away from the worry of having no money, having nowhere to live, being homeless, ending up in jail, all those things. You know, I was still running. So while I was doing this like daytime show in Radio 1, I was still running. I was expecting any second someone to go fraud back, you know, and that never escaped me in those early days.
Such a common theme from everyone I seem to talk to, or maybe it's more everyone that's from a working class background or whatever else. There's always that fear of someone's about to say, what are you doing here?
Yeah.
Hang on, how have you got by for so long?
Well,
you're out on your ear.
You know,
what's going on?
It's a thing that we're programmed with at a time when you're not, as a kid, you're not really compass-mentous enough to go, okay, I'm not going to allow that to be how I'm socially programmed. Unfortunately, when we can't do anything about it.
I was discussing this. I mean, we're just about in South London now, and I was talking to a mate of mine recently saying I've always felt more comfortable in South London.
Mm.
And she was saying, it's the opposite. I always feel slightly more threatened and it's not as nice. And I was like, that's what gives me the comfort. I think that slight feeling of it being slightly on edge. If I'm in nicer areas, it always feels that exact thing.
Absolutely.
Even just out in the street, they're about to go, back to the station, mate. Go on,
Back
to the station. Don't know how you got past. But
and I think eventually we all reach that place where we become a little bit more wise and a little older and also, you know, perspective and all those things that change it. But certainly during that era with Edith, we were two maddens, you know. We were, looking back at it now, really passionate about what we were doing. And I'm very as proud of the fact that, you know, what happened back then, there was a bit of a playoff, really, and that you kind of liked a third of the playlist.
Yeah.
You kind of tolerated another third and absolutely hated a third other.
You hated and...
Well, there's nothing better than coming off the back of something you fucking hate, knowing that you're about to play Biffy Clyro, which sounds like a mainstream reference now, but back then it wasn't.
At that point, and it wasn't at all.
They pop into my head of being an artist that was able to play Daytime Radio 1 to, I think, we'd 5.5 million listeners who were eating beans and toast and who were fucking brilliant then. And if anything, I'm not doing the snobby thing, but, you know, certainly that album, the breakthrough album, the two albums before they broke through in that album would be my favourite little era.
Yeah.
Of Biffy Clyro. Loads of examples of it. It's not only new music as well. I think we throw our heritage away very quickly musically.
Yeah.
So I was also proud in Radio 1 of still playing bands like the Manics.
Yeah.
And not saying, well, hold on, how old are you now? That's what a lot of bollocks.
It's one of the things, and we'll get to it, but it's one of the things I loved about your a late show was exactly that, was you could go, oh, actually, this song isn't brand new. I'm not breaking this new artist, but it never got the fucking respect it deserves. Absolutely. You know what I mean? No one knew about this, and this was a brilliant song.
But there was two things about that. Well, the other band I want to mention is, can you imagine Sigur Rós album tracks in Radio 1 today in the afternoon? It just wouldn't happen. But we were, look, our ratings were higher then than they are now, yet we were able to do that. And I do feel that there's a middle ground between how it sounds now. And I'm not talking about the style of music. Yeah, I'm not talking about genre music. That's bang on, and it should never make, Radio 1 should never make sense to the average 40-year-old, and never fucking should. No. But I think I also witnessed, as I was leaving to join Five Live, I think the stripping away of that ability to once an hour, once every 90 minutes, once every 2 hours to go, you know what? That was Girls Aloud and that was Coldplay, but this is Ara Bader by Sigur Rós, and it will break your fucking heart.
To put that individual imprint on, to show here's what I'm bringing, rather than just, and again, there's a huge skill, as we were discussing before we started recording, actually, of simply being a presenter.
Yeah.
But the fact is, with things like, and Joe O'Reilly is one who gave us some of our first daytime play, and it was like, there was no, and I don't know, it's a weird one, because my thought is always, looking back, however many million, there's a lot of them who aren't going to be into us.
Yeah.
But man, it's amazing that someone had the right and ability to play that just because they chose. Like, you might like this. You might not, but you might like this. And Sigur Rós is a funny one, because when you and Edith were doing that, I was working in HMV, and you see the influence and power of it, because that then became an album that we'd have on in the store constantly.
Oh, wow.
And it was like, I associate Sigur Rós hugely with my time at HMV, because that was one of the records that, and you can't play any album. There's certain, there has to be a certain size for you to get away with having it on in the store. Oh, and that was one that, it was like, wow, we're getting to play this rather than just, here's this Girls Aloud song or whatever else. Which, again, Girls Aloud make some great pop songs. I ain't hating there.
Again, though, and yeah, absolutely. I mean, I have a version of Love Machine that they made for my birthday.
Amazing.
Which was mainly quite sleazy and about me trying to sleep with one of them. Back then, that was all right on daytime radio. Yeah. But the nighttime, the new music and alternative classics thing in the evening show was very much from, well, the first thing was I was determined not to have any musical apartheid. Mm-hmm. I also felt that John P was very, and I'm not in any way going to claim that I listened to every Festa 50 my old childhood growing up, because I didn't, but he was a guy who I learned a lot from in the time that I was there. We had a riot. I remember I broke my hand, and I'd switched obviously from night times to day times.
Yeah.
And I remember he walked past me coming in the door, and he went, and I had my arm in a sling, and he went, what happened there? Did you get that for crimes to fucking music? You know, and we always had we spent the whole time talking about football, the whole time talking about Brilliant. Liverpool. And I had so... And the thing that about John Peel that always infuriated me was the idea that John Peel sat on every show and went, I care about what label it's on, and I only want to play things that nobody's listening to look clever. He was the opposite of that. Yeah. So... He, you know, you look at some of his favourite tracks of all time, Status Quo, Down, Down. To this day, one of the greatest things I've ever heard in the radio, Highlander's happy hardcore version of Hard For Me To Say I'm Sorry. Hold now. Tough For Me is still one of the fucking greatest tunes of all time. He broke the Strokes. He broke the White Stripes. Yeah. Even so, right up until his last days, he was playing the bands first. Why? Because he listened to the tunes.
Yeah,
he sat in a room, played them, and went, I like these. And I always had that in my head. If you're going to take one thing from the, you know, the greatest music DJ of all time, take that. Don't try and be him. Don't try and talk like him. Don't try and be a clone of him, because just be yourself like he was. But don't fucking throw a record out because it sold a million copies, because he never did.
Completely. And it's what I always thought when he passed, and there was all this, this person's the next John Peel, this person's the next John Peel. The one that always got me was John Kennedy, because he wasn't on that big station, but he was tucked away in the middle of the night on XFM doing exactly that, going from like grime records that he broke that you'd never think John Kennedy broke this grime record, but it was like, oh, this is a lovely, I really enjoy it, you know, and it's like, it's exactly that, it's that same thing of that just passion and love for it, and the listening to absolutely everything, which,
and
again,
I was so lucky.
I didn't have that. I couldn't manage that.
I was so lucky because I had three very different people who worked on my nighttime show originally. Yeah. And it was the team that I worked on when I first started in Nighttime Radio National was a guy called Rob Lewis, who was fantastic. Yeah. Loved radio, young enough for me to connect with. Then we had a really kind of like completely different intelligentsia, radio nerd who would have made Kenny Everett look like a part-timer, yeah. Do you know what I mean? At radio, it was like Joe Harland, who was fantastic, still there now. And then I had this little scraggy, scruffy little young BA called Annie McManus, right. Who she went on to do all right, you know what I mean? But she was my broadcast assistant. She yeah. was like, you know, the bottom amazing. Rung of the ladder, little Annie Mac, and, you know, and she was like... I really want to DJ, and we were all like, yeah, you should go for it. Fucking yeah. hell, she did not, did she?
Did
but
right.
what a team to have somebody like yeah. her as a kid going, I like this dance record, and she put it on, and her and Rob Lewis would put on Dave Clark or whatever, which I didn't have that in my repertoire.
Yeah.
And I would be like, fuck yes, that's amazing, just what track, Play the Wolf, whatever. You know. And all that was coming from them, while I had a completely different thing that I like with music, and it all came together. And I always had a good team. I always was lucky there to have that.
For me, it's that lack of ego that allows you to do the Miles Davis thing. And it's strange to compare you running your radio show to Miles Davis putting out a record. But
I'm having it.
Yeah, take it. But the fact is, a Miles Davis record has loads of people that aren't Miles Davis on it.
Yeah.
But it's because he's got that ability to go, wow, you take the stage for a minute. You yeah. you run with this. This is amazing. And yeah. step back. And that's what was exciting. That and it's where our brief run of the spoken words surgery
yeah.
it came. And it was after, I think, I'd been on a few times and we'd chatted.
Yeah.
And you said, look, would you be up for doing a weekly thing?
Yeah.
That's the spoken words surgery. And originally, I think it was going to be... I think you originally asked if I'd write something... topical each week, and
yeah.
at that point,
that's typical me, by the way. Fucking hell, could you write something new every week, please? Which is ridiculous.
But again, it's similar to your outlook there. My thing was at that point, I was getting some good daytime play. I was yeah. getting tons of exposure on numerous things. I was like, not in an arrogant way, but I don't need it.
Yeah,
it's like I'd rather
yeah.
put other people over. So yeah. so it became a thing where I'd do it as if it was a problem that we're yeah. trying to solve. And
yeah.
I'd choose a poet and say, like, what's your poem about? Right, I'll now write a medical issue. And it was based, I was driving home one night, and it wasn't a dig, but I was driving home one night and Kelly Osbourne was doing her surgery thing yeah. on Radio 1, which was... completely unqualified, advising yeah. people on all yeah. sorts of mental health or physical issues. Yeah. And it was like...
It didn't last long, though.
This is hilarious. Yeah. It was like, and again, it wasn't hated. I genuinely found it entertaining, but I was like, this is crazy. So I wanted to do a similar thing.
Yeah.
And again, it's that whole late night thing of going under the radar meant we could get away with it, because it yeah. was kind of mocking something that was on Radio 1.
And we got away with it.
And we got away with it. And it was that. I'd like, right, so what's your poem about? Right, I'll write in a fake, oh, we've got this person who's got this illness, and I've got a special surgeon in
yeah.
in Jodie-Anne Bickley or Kate Tempest or
yeah.
Polar Bear or any of these guys that have gone on to do amazing things as well. And they're going to give, you know, a solution to that and an antidote.
And where that went right back to, is, if my memory serves me right, which is one of the worst memories in the history of the planet, but
same.
Is that... Because, oh God, this sounds so dated now, but it's like Y2K. But we had the first internet feature, so at a time when the way you got music off the internet was, well, the way you stole music was a thing called LimeWire.
Yeah.
And really dodgy places yeah. that you'd type anything in and you'd get it.
Yeah.
And we wanted to do like a 45 minutes a week, which was just a mismatch of stuff that people hadn't really discovered yet outside yeah. of a very small amount. Pulling stuff off, like, say, for example, Sonus Quartet covers and... If they were going, then were they? I yeah. think they were. And Christopher Riley doing Radiohead and internet. You know, because at that time, people wouldn't have played, say, for example, the best bit of Eddie Murphy Raw
yeah.
or Delirious or on the radio. And we wanted to put together this 45 minutes was a bit of this and a bit of that and a bit of something else.
Yeah.
You know, this is some fucking mad band from San Francisco who've just done like a string quartet version of Where Is My Mind.
Yeah.
And that was... When I was doing that nighttime show, that was just all beginning, and it wasn't yeah. like, so what YouTube is now was what that section was then.
It was like a miscellaneous section, and that's which is the most exciting section in anything.
Yeah, because yeah. you never knew you were going to get, you know, yeah. you would be getting the, you know, we would literally play the fucking C is for Cookie song from yeah. Sesame Street, followed by yeah. a bit of spoken word
yeah.
that we'd, and we probably were like stealing your material to begin with, because
yeah.
we would have been just lifting that
just offline.
And
yeah,
then
yeah.
the next thing, I remember we played that whole, and this is how radio was, could you imagine getting away with this? So it was after 9 o'clock, right? And I remember we played the entire section of Eddie Murphy's thing about when he went around when Bill Cosby rang him
yeah,
to
yeah.
say you shouldn't swear on stage.
Right. Yeah, yeah.
And it has the punchline. He says, I rang Richard Pryor, and Richard Pryor said, tell a motherfucker next time he rings to suck my dick. We played that out. Like, it was amazing. Looking back on it, and I did appreciate it then, and I'm so glad I did.
Yeah.
I did appreciate it then.
Yeah.
And I think that's when we first played spoken word. It's the first time that, and I recreated that for a thing called Soundscape for Six Music just before I moved to TalkSport.
Yeah.
And I wanted to keep it going because it did really well, but politics dictated that for some reason in the media bubble that the idea of somebody who was on Talk Sport being in Six Music just wouldn't do, you know, it'd be like having shit on the shoe of the BBC. But it's such a shame it didn't happen again because it was such a success. Those four, we did a half hour Soundscape with no talking of just these subjects.
It's such a weird world in the politics of all that.
Yeah.
When I went in for my meeting at XFM and got my XFM show, the first thing I said was, I'm only going to do it if I'm allowed to acknowledge that Radio 1 and Six Music exist. I want to say, I heard this on Zane's show or Huey Morgan played this the other week, because the fact is they all exist and we all know exist. It shouldn't be a competition. Again, I keep harping on about podcasts, but what I love about podcasts is most of the new podcasts I learn about are from other podcasts saying, oh shit, you've got to hear this, rather than being all secretive and exclusive.
The worst one I ever had of that was I was presenting UEFA Cup stuff and I was referencing Champions League games and one of the bosses sent a message down saying, can you stop mentioning the Champions League? As if people were going to stop watching the fucking or stop watching the better tournament. And I was like, no.
They're not going to have heard of it yet. They're going to be watching the Euros and go, what's this Champions League you keep talking about?
Yeah, what is this? So I was like, actually, we want to connect ourselves to that as much as possible. Because right now we're showing fucking Spurs away to Dnipro at 5 p.m. Yeah. So we can connect ourselves to Barcelona at Real Madrid.
Then that's a hell of a...
Very bizarre how that whole world works. It tends to be with people who've never broadcast them. And that's the thing about it.
It's weird exclusiveness. But it was...
How spoken word sort of came into my world, I think, from my memory.
Crazy thing at the time, because at the time, again, we were all doing a million different things. So I was like, oh, this sounds fun, But it's been since then that I've had people who've come up in the Roundhouse Collective and just people who are doing great in the spoken word scene come up to me and say that I first heard stuff when it was on that spoken word surgery.
I didn't realise it was that powerful back then.
I didn't think about that at all.
And not saying that it's responsible
for the blow up of it, but you realise that you're putting spoken word out to, it may not be the tens of millions in daytime, but it's still a load of people who potentially wouldn't have had access to listen to it. There would already have been people into spoken word, but they're not the people that are listening to Radio 1 at that point. And that's what's exciting about
it. This might be the bit you don't like. My reasons for putting it out were absolutely nothing to do with that.
Yeah.
They were based in the same logic and principle of we liked it.
Yeah.
You know, so I never came from the point of view, I was never trying to support a scene. I was never trying to give people something that they didn't have, if you know what I mean.
Yeah.
Like, we were under a little pressure in terms of getting the balance right, and I've always fought them away, and I said, look, I'm just going to play what I like, and some shows I would have done would have been quite mainstream and other shows would have been less so, but I also knew that if I wanted people to listen to the unknown bit of spoken word, the track before it couldn't be another piece of unspoken unknown spoken word. It needed to be the track I liked best by the Flaming Lips. So, bad example, because I fucking love them, but you know, it needed to be a band who I like, and I like that track, and I knew that loads of people like that track, and I could more than live with playing it, because I knew that that would just mean there'd be 300,000 more people would hear Letter from God to Man, or whatever it would be, and that is the art of radio to this day. And even with sport, it's like, I want to talk about the team from amateur football who've been kicked out of their league, and I know that if people are going to listen to that, I need... Alan Shearer on after the news and before that piece to be talking about Manchester United's new signings, and it's that bit in the middle that makes the show, and it was always those tracks that made the show, but I didn't do it to support a scene, and that's the difference between the artist and the presenter.
It's genuinely a simple psychological thing there as well, is it buys you a bit more time of the bit that they're not familiar with, and I find that again DJing in clubs is, if there's a new song I want to play that I'm nervous about, I'll make sure it's coming after something that will get them all on board.
Absolutely.
And they'll have that little bit of faith and already be up, already be a bit happy and buzzy, that I can drop that. If I played the four new songs in a row, then you're dead.
Absolutely.
Or it might go off, but it's a bigger risk. Whereas if you can do that, right, I've got their trust.
Yeah.
Now, have a look at this. Oh, shit, they're liking it. This is great.
You have to do it like that. Yeah. And the more you do it, and the more repetitive you do it, and the more you connect those tracks together, and then all of a sudden it becomes that. And your audience, like, and you asked earlier, so like, why radio? I love radio now, and it's my absolute home. I still love to write, and I still have to always be writing something.
Yeah.
But I couldn't live without writing something. I've been lucky to have 4 years at the Metro now, and it's just amazing. The most. I just love Thursday afternoon sitting down, just me. If I could do it, you know, I would like. I see myself at 60. You know, in the middle of nowhere, only doing that, you know.
Typing away.
And maybe doing a radio show using some sort of weird technology. It's probably just going to be talking into a phone, into your watch by then. It'll probably be radio quality. But radio is a place where you cannot lie.
Yeah.
You can if you're a news presenter, whatever, but if you're going to really do something like sport or music or something that has a passion to it, you cannot lie to your audience. As long as you don't lie to them, they don't have to like you, and they don't have to like all your choices or all your opinions, but just don't lie to them because they hear it.
Yeah.
And they don't mind you even making mistakes. They don't mind you getting it wrong, but they fucking hate if you're not being yourself.
Yeah.
And I've always found that anything I've done that hasn't been quite me has failed. And like my TalkSport show now is doing well because I'm being me.
Yeah.
It's not like the shows around it. It doesn't mean it's better or worse, but I'm just not the cynical person, and I don't think football's a matter of life or death, and I don't mind talking about falling out of love with football, and I don't mind talking a lot about FIFA before anybody else really was in radio, although there's great people doing work in print, and you know, it's just me, and that's what it is, and that kind of works. And with Edith and I, it was always the same in Radio 1. With me, when I took over that Peel slot, again another poison chalice, and it was like my thought process, I was confident because I knew just be you.
Yeah.
And that it's not about you being good or you being great. It's about you being you.
You being you and being honest.
Yeah. And anyone listening that's starting in radio and television is different. It's a horrible sort of awkward lover that I kind of have.
Yeah.
That I would gladly never sleep with again, but you kind of have to. I do harbour a great ambition one day to find a TV show that gives me what radio's given me, and I never have. But anyone that's this now, it's like just, like, be nice to everybody. Like, you know, really work hard. All those things that have existed for decades are still true now.
Yeah.
And be yourself. Don't go to bed thinking the accent you have to talk with in the radio the next day is different than the one you just kissed your love of your life goodnight with, you know.
Completely.
Just don't make it different, because you'll have a lot. I know people who've done that and they've been fairly successful, but they can't maintain it.
Completely.
Because you cannot maintain phoniness in radio.
No, 100%. You know? There's two things that jump out there, which I kind of want to wrap things up on, and I'll go just quickly on you talking about TV, and you've had some great stuff in there. I remember watching a great snooker documentary, the
85
final, which was
just amazing. That. It's one of the diamonds amongst my rubble of television. Yeah,
but that's it.
That, yeah,
the thing to me, you've said, and we were talking beforehand, the kind of the love-hate with TV, the not finding the right place. All I can say to you is the darts. Because the darts is...
which is gone now, of course.
It was the one that, soon as I tuned into that, because again, I didn't know... I became aware of you as a music guy.
Yeah.
So then when you were suddenly on sports stuff, it was odd. And the darts was the one that I was like, this is so perfect. Like, it felt so home and spot on for you.
I don't know how many of those years I did, maybe like 8 years. The BBC have just dropped it.
Yeah.
And so that's my thoughts.
I wasn't even aware of that. That's a great show.
Yeah, just dropped it. I actually think it's not, and I kind of agree with it, because, you know, a lot of the stuff that's happened in darts, not to bore people with darts, but it is a stage now where I think the gap between the two, it was getting harder and harder to say, you know, this is a world champion in this stage. And I don't mean that disparagingly, but it was always that case. Look, there's only ever been a couple of champions ever in PDC history that didn't win the BDO first.
Yeah.
But that's changing, and great players coming through like Keegan and Smith and youth players coming through now in PDC are usurping the best of the BDO, in my opinion, and it became much more difficult. I wish...
For me, always had those true characters.
Yeah.
And then there was still obviously a high level, but it was so much you've got these amazing characters and weird, and it made it entertaining, and then...
Absolutely. I think the gaps just became too big.
Yeah.
I just wish there was about 4 or 5 years ago, Hearn offered $1 million to buy them out, and I knew he would have done quite a good job with it. He was going to keep it, and I wish it had happened, but there you go, that's history. But The weight, again, yeah, that probably was an example of when I managed to find a little bit of radio and TV, because the guy beside me does not know how to lie.
Yeah.
And Bobby George 100%. Is just one of the greatest human beings I've ever met. And, you know, I love Bobby like a family member, you know. And he is, you know, he rings me once every 3 weeks. Oh, son, give us a fucking ring back before it fucking snows, you fucking, you know. Like, he is just a fan. Bobby is one of the just, and you know, at times, Bobby makes me want to fucking curl up in the ball and cringe at some things he'll say, right? Not on air, you know, just like, because he's a proper old man. Like, he makes me laugh so much. But, like, he would fucking give me the shirt off his back. Like, I absolutely adore him. And to explain what I mean about television, it's not that it's this horrible thing. It's not. And for many people, it's great for them. But I every morning plan a radio show by sitting down and going, right, what's the big things? What's the small things? What's happening? Right, how can we invent that and make that? You know, so how can we take, for example, that story and where is it going to go to? And, okay, here's roughly what we're going to do and let's let it develop.
Yeah.
Like, for example, Owen Coyle was made manager of Blackburn last week and he managed Burnley. And the owners of Blackburn are at loggerheads still with the fans, the Venkies, and they won't even sit down with a consortium that want to buy 51%.
Yeah.
I'm not saying they need to sell it, but sit down with them.
Yeah,
everybody knew that story, you know, so I was able to run through that story. And then we just did, you know, because I know the presenters I have on that day, and that guy's a comedian, that guy likes to laugh. We did a, like, what was the conversation in that room when they decided Owen Coyle was the right guy for the job? You couldn't have picked, you know, you could not have picked a more inappropriate manager at the moment.
Yeah.
That, like, it sent the Blackburn fans into meltdown. You know, we run through that sort of, like, where in the list did they come to? And that's what radio is, you know. It's everything like is a challenge. Steve
West
Lomas.
Ham legend still Steve Lomas.
Yeah, do you know what? I'm going to give you a part of the show you're going to have to bleep out. But the main song as he walked out for the first time was West Ham cunt.
Yeah.
West Ham cunt. Yeah. What? Like, you know, put on the level of that, Owen Coyle being the Blackburn manager. Yeah. And it was ludicrous. But rather than sort of be all stern faced and act like football's a be all and end all, you know, you look at how you can twist it, have fun with it.
Exactly.
And all that.
Fun with it.
This is what TV is, right? This is so, so important. And because I did 3 years of Match of Day too, and look, I've tried my best in my career to make my decisions based on creativity and happiness.
Yeah.
Forget ratings, forget money, forget everything. Yeah. And that was one of the few times after like a year that I made a decision based on profile. And I should have, after a year, went, this isn't for me. I don't think I was very good at it. I thought I was always trying to box my way out of the box that it was, rather than realizing that that box wasn't for me in the first place.
Right.
And it caused irrevocable damage, I think, in terms of, I don't give a fuck, but in terms of career. And it's this, that when you're watching Match of the Day, Match of the Day 2, and Sky Sports and whatever else, do you realize that when the pundit says, this is what I think happened, and then they run something that illustrates that. That was made 4 hours ago. Yeah. So now reverse the process. He had to have told that guy 4 hours ago that he wanted to point out that the left back was out of position.
Yeah.
He then had to tell me that that's what he wanted to talk about. And I had to ask him something appropriate so he could lead into that.
Yeah.
It is mind-numbingly dull. And that's why I ended up in the paper every month for making an inappropriate comment, because I was so fucking frustrated.
I did
you know?
a show on BT Sports for a little while, an MMA show called Fighting Talk, actually, which was a popular
nothing
name.
Like being original. Well done. Fuck yeah.
I was doing that, and it got, I always got tons of love on there, and this guy Dan Hardy, who's an ex-fighter, got loads of love, and OJ
Ball. He did the Clipper race recently, Dan Hardy.
Yeah, he's doing amazing things, but OJ Borge was the presenter of it, and he always got a lot of stick, but the fact, I'd always defend him, because the fact is, he's the one that's got an earpiece in, having to do all this awkward shit. And me and Dan get to go there and talk excitedly about fights. And that's it.
Yeah.
We've got the easiest job in the world. He's the one that's got to go, now I have to ask this question to lead on to this, or I have to ask that. That people say, it just seems like he's got an agenda. It's like, well, yeah, he's got an agenda. It's a TV show.
Yeah.
The
person who'll get the most stick.
Again, it's that weird thing of TV.
Yeah.
And that was even as one of the ones who was getting, I never got a bad word when I was on it. I'd have some people saying, why is this guy on there?
Yeah.
Who is he? What's he got to do with MMA? But as soon as we started talking, they'd go, all right, no, he knows what he's talking about.
And the other thing is, his job is probably to sit as close to the centre as he can.
Yeah,
and unfortunately, in the world of fandom and passion, whether it be football, whether it be music, if you sit, especially in sport, if you sit in the middle and you can see both sides, well, you're actually biased to both sides.
Yeah.
Because that's not what being a fan is. It still frustrates me these days when I hear, And sometimes it happens to people have on my show and they're like, I'd rather you didn't say what football team I supported. And I'm like, why the fuck not?
Yeah.
Don't be here then.
Yeah.
Go away and fucking ban allotment and sit there and listen to the other people be passionate. Because, and that's what I love about Talk Sport. You know, we ask our audience to trust us when the red light's on, not to be biased in our, not to be vindictive against those who would be our rivals.
That's it. It's the
but at the same time,
it's fine to have bias.
It's fine to be biased, of course.
You're a passionate
supporter. But don't hide our passion. Yeah. Like, wouldn't it be awful if I was going on the radio for the Euros and going, well, obviously I would be just as delighted if Wales won or England than Northern Ireland. Fucking what? I'd be glad they all went out. I'd be glad they were all disqualified just for us to win one match. And that's the thing. And I would hope an England fan would say, on hearing that, I know that 90% of England fans or more would go, good on you, because that's exactly how I feel about England.
And it was the beautiful thing with the whole Agent Lomas thing and Steve Lomas at Mill was I was getting so much sick from West Ham fans. But it was funny and it was right and it was fair. And the fact is, we still one of, like, Mill will get a lot of stick for a lot of the bad things in their history or whatever else, but still one of the wittiest moments in history was when West Ham had their last game and were going down from the Premiership and a plane flew over with a banner that said Avram Grant, Millwall legend. Someone had gone to the trouble, and even all my West Ham man faces like, that was fair
that
play.
That was all right.
We're gutted that we're getting relegated, but that was funny. That was fair play.
That's why I will
the
never...
The thought that's gone into that.
Some fan bases have a history of things that absolutely they need to take responsibility
100%,
for. 100%. And that stretches across various fan bases. But I will never let that minority, whether it's a few people or a few hundred or a few thousand, ever take away the fact that, you know, I probably know 50 to 60 Chelsea fans and none of them would have been those guys in the train in Paris.
Yeah,
and I know hundreds of Liverpool fans and hundreds of Manchester United fans and none of them would have been those fined for chance at the Europa League game. And I always try my best in radios to say, look, I'm not excusing it. I'm saying that they shouldn't. Recently I did a thing on air saying we should ban pitch invasions because if the players now are being confronted by these idiots coming on the pitch. And sometimes, yes, we all have to suffer because of the small amount of people. Mm-hmm. But I'm always trying my best to not allow the silent majority to be ignored in what I do in sport. Because I grew up in an era where the silent majority were afraid socially, politically, to speak up. Because they were worried about the consequence that would come up. And that's always stuck with me, even though sport's so less important in life and death and life, you know, in how you grow up. It still sticks with me. Like, I know the power of the silent majority when they find their voice. And I always try and put that across. I think that's important in sport. But TV for me is always, I've felt like it's a straitjacket.
Yeah.
And I hope one day I'll find something. But hey, I don't fucking need to. Do you know what I mean?
Exactly.
Like, so I love the radio and I just... You know, I really do. I have such a passion for it.
And that's the view of it. I have people ask, oh, because the podcast is doing well, and people say, so what's the plan with this? Is it going to be a radio show? Is it going to be a TV show?
I know what you should do. Film it.
The plan is this. This was the plan, and it's better than I could have hoped.
I know.
But the thing that, again, I'll wrap things up completely now, because I need to let you get on your way. But
I'm okay for 14 minutes.
Well, let's get to the thing that always I found really inspiring from you was... When a Radio 1 are having one of their shuffles and move arounds, it's a scary moment. Mm. There's people who are like, shit, this is the end of my career. I'm having the rug pulled from underneath me.
Yeah.
I'm being moved on. Essentially, there's probably a psychological thing of I'm being told I'm old now. Because as you said, data on Radio 1 shouldn't make sense to a 40-year-old.
Absolutely.
You know, things like that. It's like, in many ways, this is a big thing. But the thing I loved when you moved on from Radio 1 was it just went... from strength to strength. And again, I said, I didn't really know that much about the sport passion and things like that. And it wasn't, it's like right now I'm smashing it in sports radio and on TV and all these other things. It was like, wow, he didn't spend a year going, oh, what do I do?
Mm.
Can I get a small slot on Six Music or can I go on to this or that? It was like, cool.
Well, I tried to leave earlier.
Thanks for letting me go.
I tried to leave earlier, a year earlier. And the boss at that stage, Andy Parfitt, said, look, he said some very nice things to me, took me out and said, this is why I want you to stay. It's not a commercial thing. I feel like you need to have different layers of a station. And I see you as the little sprinkle that I need at the moment. And I thought, okay. and instead an extra year and left just for 31st birthday. But when I was like 22, 23, 24, and I watched how, and I observed how there was a Radio 1, Radio 2 thing that happened, and then Six Music was invented in that. And I have no problem with that, but I knew then I didn't want to be that guy.
Right.
I didn't and still don't want to be playing the records that I discovered when I was 24 to the same people when I was 44.
Yeah.
I've ran away from that ever since. So I gave them a year's notice. And one of the things that will always stick in my head that was really, really frustrated me, and I have so many nice memories about Radio 1, but that year when it came around to the Radio Academy Awards, they didn't enter me in any of the categories because they said it would look bad if I won as I was leaving. Mm. And that was the one thing stopping me. I thought, what a really bad low blow. And the other thing that happened
was 2007, a winner of the Radio Academy Awards as best
music we got then. Got the music award back then. I always say we because like Natasha Linson and Rachel McElroy were just fantastic with me.
And Natasha was amazing when we were sorting out good. All the spoken word stuff as well.
So I was already doing Fight and Talk and Five Live. So the switch to Five Live, I made that. I had a year to sort it out, which was really good. But you know, it's funny about things that some people look down their nose at, because I broke some bands who I haven't liked since they became big. So I was the biggest Snow Patrol fan ever when they were on Jeepster.
Yeah.
And I remember Final Straw coming through and having stand-up arguments about playing Run, which I still think is a fucking amazing piece of pop music.
Yeah.
And okay, I didn't like the album after that because they chose that this mainstream world was going to be one that they moved in, they were ensconced in rather than would sort of maybe stay in the edges of a bit.
Sure.
But still very proud of the fact that, you know, those early records. But The Darkness was another one. I got a claim responsibility for some as well. The Darkness, I remember I remember the Pyramid stage when that all blew up and they played that. The last song they did in the set was Get Your Hands Off My Woman, Motherfucker.
Yeah.
And at the very end of it, which goes, Get Your Hands Off My Woman, Motherfucker. Wow. And it finishes. They went, Get Your Hands Off of My Woman. Stop the gig. Just silence. People cheered. And Justin went, Thanks, Colin. Motherfucker. And then, you know, that is one of the greatest five things that's ever happened to me, that connection between the, you know, I always argue passionate. And I remember Joe Harland, who I mentioned earlier, one of the few crosswords we had. He came up to me and he said, I had a band on who were unsigned in one of my last ever sessions in Radio 1. And he said, just look, keep a lid on it. I know you're leaving, but there's still consequences. You can't just have unsigned bands in playing some form of country music. I mean, I think it's taking the piss a bit. And I went, okay, fair enough. Just for the record, they'll be the biggest band in the world. And he laughed. He went, no, they won't. And I went, no. Seriously, they will. So that session was Mumford and Sons.
Of course it was.
I think I've always had a decent ear for that. And then,
I love it.
But so I never wanted to have my fingernails in the door of Radio 1 being dragged out.
Being pushed onto that again.
I never
you're this or that.
I just wanted to be the guy who, and now I harbour very different ambition, but I always want to make sure I'm pushing. I became very comfortable with the Poison Chalice. When you sort of are an underdog to begin with and haven't done radio, and you know you're an underdog in the newspaper because you don't have a qualification, you're an underdog at Radio 1 because you've never done radio, you're an underdog in the afternoons because you're replacing Mark and Large, you're an underdog at night because you're replacing fucking John Peel.
Yeah.
You know, it kept happening. You know, even when it came to TalkSport, it was Keys and Gray, you know, and it was like a real kind of strong sentiment for and against that show in a weird way. I've always had that.
And it was stepping in at a point where people have been forced out when the audience might not have liked it, or there was a lot of tension over.
Yeah, so again, there was all sorts.
It was a very tough one to walk into. And
but I kind of have learned to treat that as the imposter that it is, you know, and that's what I like about radio. You don't need to worry about doing interviews. You don't need to worry about press because people just switch the radio on and hear the voice and either connect or don't.
Yeah.
That's what radio is. All success in radio is based on hard work, you know?
There's numerous shows on TalkSport that I've listened to loads, and I still don't know which one's which. I love those two guys. Yeah. It's like, I don't know which. Yeah. I, but again, it's that I connect to them, their voices as a pair.
And that's what it is.
I'm not paying enough attention to when which name is which.
I know exactly what you mean. I always say to people on my radio show, one of the acid tests is they think, because people obviously have a lot of other things going on in their life.
Yeah.
And one of the most common things people do, although I don't know how they do it, but I have Steve Bunce on a Wednesday and Bob Mills on a Friday, and people genuinely get them mixed up.
Yeah.
And I have no idea how people can, but they do.
Yeah,
you know?
Yeah.
And do you know what radio is? Radio was something that is meant to provide a friend or a bit of company to the listener. That's what I think. Yeah, if you're 100%. Doing a, if you're doing a show when people are driving to work, it's slightly different, or driving back from work. That's why they're called Breakfast and Drive.
Yeah.
That's why they have the highest ratings. It's about bang, 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 big story, big story, big story. Then repeat, bang, 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 big. So that's why the records are bigger, the stories are bigger. From 10 o'clock to 5 o'clock, radio's about being company for people who are at work, who are alone at home, who are traveling. And that's why I love the slots. That's why I've always asked for the afternoon slots over the big ones. Completely. Because this is where you can make people's life a little bit more tolerable.
And I genuinely think it makes a massive difference on the talk element of it as well. Because the fact is, with music, it's time's sensitive breaks. So either I'm enjoying this song, it's on for this amount of time. I'm not enjoying that song, it's on for that amount of time. Whereas with a conversation, it's potentially never ending. Do you know what I mean? It's that you can lose half an hour easily.
Yeah.
And it's like, right, that was that. Rather than, oh, it's been four songs or five songs. It's that just becomes one section. It's like, that felt like 2 minutes, but it's been half hour of discussion.
And there's nothing better when you know, a conversation starts at A and ends up at F or G or H, and then you take a break, and then you just click on your internet and it just goes poof, and your response is there from people, and you go, they've connected to it, they get it, we're having this conversation together, you know. That's what radio is, and it hasn't changed. And you know what? I don't think it will. Yeah, maybe it'll diminish, and maybe it'll change how people listen to it, and maybe the format they listen will change and all that, everything like that. But look, I always say this, people who go online to date and people who now internet date and use internet to do it, they don't have any different feeling when they turn up for that date than my grandmother or grandfather had when they met.
Yeah.
Scared fucking shitless.
Yeah.
Worried they're not going to be good in bed. Worried they're going to say the wrong thing. Worried they get sweat patches under their arm.
Yeah.
Wondering what their table manners are when they have it. You know,
the real life bit still has to happen. The
real life bit's still the same. And that's what's fantastic about human connection.
You can dance around the digital bit as long as you want, but at some point,
absolutely, the real life human connection remains exactly the same, I think.
That's perfect. Well, we'll end it there. Thank you very much for coming on.
What a pleasure.
Is there anything you want to, is like anything that, ahead that you're excited about or want to push or plug? Or
I have waited quite a long time to do it, partly because he kind of was the sort of, everyone has their heroes in their life, but my grandfather was that.
Yeah.
And when he passed away way too early, about 10 years ago, and it's been one of those things where the first 3-4 years, you know, didn't mention his name, you know,
yeah.
And then you sort of, you become comfortable with the sort of the loss. And we found out, after he passed away, that he may have not been what he said he was. So I now know for a fact that the thing that he asked, sort of, for example, my auntie, the oldest sister, to keep quiet, that he was MI6, has all started to come through.
Wow.
And I've now learned about Burmese prisoner of war camps. And so I'm going to write a book about, you know, was my grandfather James Bond? I've no idea. I just know that he, my mum said a brilliant thing. I said, can you tell me anything about that era of your childhood? And she went, he definitely wasn't MI6. I mean, we lived in England for a bit, some weird place, but like that was just because we moved our family. So what was it called? And she went, I have no idea, love, like Belgium. I went, would that be Bletchley? And she went, aye, that was it. Somehow did you know that? And I was like, okay, I think he might have been involved then. So I think he might have been some sort of code breaker of some sort. And I suppose that my unfulfilled ambition is to write more.
Yeah.
So this summer I'm going to sort of try a piece of fiction and started working on to really sort of embrace that, and to write this book about my grandfather, and generally try and do these things that are less about money and commercialism and more about, you know, I've put these off long enough.
I mean, the trouble everyone always says with writing, and particularly writing a book of any point, is the motivation to get to the end of it, to finish it, to complete this, to get the work done. I couldn't think of a project that anyone could be more motivated to research and get excited it's and more, get to the bottom of, because it's as much for you to go, so what was this?
Yeah.
What was going on? That sounds like an amazing project.
It's been more about getting to the stage where I can handle listening to people talk about them.
Yeah,
and and I've been there for a few years, and I don't know why it's taken me so long to pull the trigger on it, but I am this summer. I've taken the time off after the Euros, and I've got 2 weeks off to probably go and interview people who are very old in our family before they pass away. I don't not be morbid, but it's now or never for in a lot of cases. So I want to get that done. I want to investigate and free up various, you know, Freedom of Information Acts and visit the places. And I only have little snippets, but I'll leave you with this, which is just this sums up the man, a great man. And he always had this thing where he'd let the odd story go if he had a drink, but he didn't drink very often at all. And when he passed away and he was on the hospital bed, and I didn't get to see it. I got to see the day before, which was great to just go up and say my goodbyes. And he was technically my dad, you know. He was the guy that brought me up, really. It felt like that. It felt like that growing up. And he always would say very little. And they were all around the bed. And I wish I'd have been there, mate. They were all around the bed. And I think my mum or my auntie said, come on, JC, you can tell us your biggest secret now. It's okay. You don't have to worry about the Official Secrets Act or anything like that. And he sort of beckoned everyone close to him. And his last words he ever said in the planet was, I shot JFK. And that was his last words in this earth. He was a great man. And I may only discover that he was a low-level code breaker.
Yeah.
But I just can't wait to go on that journey. And I think it's an interesting story to tell because World War One is now ancient history. There's nobody alive to tell the story. We're only 10, 15 years away, sadly, from World War Two being ancient history. Sadly, in that no one will be able to give you a first-hand account of it. Sure, you know, so that side of it, that journalistic side of it really appeals to me as well.
That sounds amazing. I can't wait to see how that all develops. Well, thank you very much for chatting. It's been an absolute pleasure to catch up
and discuss.
Cheers, man.
Thank you.
You've been listening to Scroobius Pip's Discretion Pieces.
There we go, two exciting parts. And we really could have rambled forever and ever. It was so, so lovely to catch up with Colin. Great dude. I love the man. So that was good. Thank you for tuning in. We're going to have more next week. Obviously, we're always back every Wednesday. If you enjoyed this, have a bit of a scroll through. But also, if you could rate us or give us a review or anything like that, it all helps us with iTunes and with the sponsors and things like that. And I'm going to be honest with you. I hear tons of podcasts say that and I just ignore them. I don't do it. So I can't really get mad at you if you don't, if I'm honest. But you know what? Next time I hear them say that, it takes moments. And I know the effect of it. It takes moments. So I'm going to give that a high score. I'm going to give Jim Ross and the Ross Report 5 stars because it's a 5-star podcast. I'm going to give The Fighter and the Kid 5 stars. I'm going to give Joe Rogan Experience 5 stars. I'm going to give Talk is Jericho 5 stars. I'm going to give Stone Cold Steve Austin podcast, both the family friendly and the unleashed one, 5 stars. I'm going to give Tuesday Night Jaw 5 stars. I'm going to give Why to Drugs 5 stars. I'm going to give everything 5 stars. 5 stars all round, because there's some great podcasts out there and I recommend you check them out. And thank you for checking us out. Anything else I need to tell you? I rambled on in part one about the book tour, but do as we're at the end of the podcast now and it's in your head still, have a little Google, grab yourself some tickets and come along to one of the live podcasts on the book tour for the Distraction Pieces podcast book. I cannot wait to see you all. It's beautiful because the thing I've missed most from being off from touring, and I'll be honest, I've been crazy busy since I've been off from touring, so I've not had that much of a chance to miss it. I was talking to Sully Breaks the other day and he was asking if I miss it, and I was like, mate, I've done, in the last year I've done 2 TV shows, a feature film, and not again, I'm not saying it's lead parts, but it's a lot. It's crazy to fit it in a year, a weekly podcast, a book, and you know, a lot of other stuff that I've not kind of put out or mentioned yet. So I've been crazy busy, but the thing I have missed is meeting all you dickheads up and down the country, because that's the great part. On all the tours we'd do, if you've been to see us before, you'll know I've done the merch at every gig that we've ever done, except for one tour at Coco where I still did it after the gig. I didn't do it before, I only did after. But yeah, so I get to meet all you guys and it's always adorable and lovely. So I'm looking forward to that on this tiny mini book tour run. Please don't get mad that we're not coming to your town or whatever. It's all I could fit in. So I appreciate all of you that come along and come hang out and buy the book and get it signed and come and ask me questions and be involved in Q&As and general delightful interaction. Thanks for tuning in, guys. I'll catch you all next week. Ta-ta.
Planning for your next trip? Elevate your travel style with Quince. Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/trip for free shipping and 365-day returns.